Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Psych Files. Michael Britt here, and this is episode 46, entitled Positive Thinking Revisited. Is it always good to try to entice yourself to think positively, to look upon negative thinking as a bad thing, something to be avoided? So that topic has not gone away, and there are a number of recent articles that have brought this back up, and in fact, some books are out now talking about the dangers of this positive thinking movement. I thought it would be worthwhile to go over those. And that's what this episode is about. One announcement from last week, though. Last week was a video episode, which I hope you enjoyed, but I forgot to mention the problem with the suspension bridge study, which is the episode before that. Now, briefly, just a brief review of that study. The idea here was that the researchers were looking to find out whether or not physiological arousal has something to do with our emotions, or at least how we label our emotions. They had two conditions in this study. One condition was a bridge, a swaying suspension bridge far off the ground, and then the other condition was a very low, stable bridge. And what happened was an attractive female researcher would wait until a man came across the bridge and walk up to him, say that she's doing a research study. Would he mind looking at some pictures and writing a short description of what he thought was happening there, fill out some questionnaires. Oh, and by the way, here's my contact information if you want to get in touch with me to see what the results of the study were. Okay, so that's what happened on the suspension bridge, and that is exactly what happened on the low, stable bridge. So that's all good, and of course what they found was that the men on the suspension bridge were far more likely to write stories with some sexual imagery in them, and were more likely to call this attractive woman sometime after the study. So this was attributed to the physiological arousal plus the presence of the woman. All right, so that supported the Schachter-Singer theory of emotions, that you need both of those things in order to get a feeling that we label, and in this case, the feeling was labeled as attracted to this person. The problem with the study is what we call the lack of random assignment of subjects to conditions. So there was no researcher standing on the, where you come onto the bridge, flipping a coin and saying, okay, you go to the suspension bridge and you go to the low bridge. Suspension, low bridge. Okay, none of that happened. The researchers took whoever crossed the bridge, whoever decided to cross the bridge, and approach him and ask him about writing stories and giving him her telephone number. So the problem is this. Think about this. What kind of a guy is likely to cross a very high swaying suspension bridge? Is he probably the kind of guy who would ask out a woman who he barely knows? I would say he probably is that kind of guy, right? He's probably a risk-taking kind of guy, probably outgoing, right? On the other hand, the guy who decides to go across the low, sturdy, regular bridge may be someone more cautious and probably less likely to call someone he doesn't know. So the reason for the dependent variable there, the calling of the researcher sometime after the study, has more to do with the subject's personality and may have nothing to do with the physiological arousal, the pairing of the attractive woman, and the rest of the theory there. Well, that is the confound for that study. Doesn't negate the theory at all, but no study is perfect, and so that would be the problem with that study. Okay, so that's that. Let's move on to our positive thinking revisited. The articles that I've seen recently, one of them came in Newsweek article, and it was called The How-To of Leading a Happy Life. Was by Jennifer Barrett, and that is in the January 28th edition of Newsweek magazine. Now, Jennifer Barrett was summarizing the work of, let's see, her name is Sonia, I hope I get this right, Lyubomirsky. Okay, hope I got that right. And she is the author of, let's see, what's a book called The How of Happiness. She had some interesting ideas. So I read this article and I thought, this is actually kind of interesting. Talks about writing letters of gratitude. And a lot of people are talking about that recently, that one of the ways that we make ourselves happy is by reminding ourselves of the good things that we have in our life and not focusing on the bad things. What are the things that are going right? Right? Being grateful. Also mentioned as part of this, the how of happiness in this article was doing things for others. which we hear also more and more talk about, that we can feel better about ourselves when we think about, well, what can I do for someone else, someone less fortunate? Journaling is also mentioned here, which I know someone who's doing this, where you take some time out of the day to write down, to make a bit more concrete some of the things we just talked about. What am I grateful for? What's going right? So journaling sounds like a good thing. And I didn't mention any of these in the previous articles, so I think there are some good ideas still coming out. Another one was the February 2008 edition of Prevention Magazine, and there was an article in there called Joy, How to Make It Last, by Siri Carpenter, S-I-R-I, and she was summarizing the work of Dr. Fred Bryant. Dr. Bryant talks about some of the things that make us unhappy, some of which we've talked about here, avoiding pessimistic thinking, of course. He's saying that we can make joy last by savoring when good things happen to us, sharing our positive feelings with others. Also the one we just mentioned, saying thank you, being grateful. One thing is mentioned that hasn't come up before, which is, and I was sort of surprised to see it, and it's simply one of his suggestions is to compare downward, which takes us into psychological theory called social comparison theory. Now, this is something that you do all the time, which is why the podcast is subtitled Psychology in Everyday Life. You didn't know that, I'll bet you, that you are doing social comparison a lot of the time during the day. You are, it's very simply, you are comparing yourself to other people. And how you do that can determine how you feel about yourself. Whenever you are uncertain about maybe how good you are at something, then you make comparisons. Now, you might think that you make these comparisons most often, and you probably do, to the people around you, right? The people in your social category, as one text put it. We've talked about equity theory and how you look at the people around you. So you can compare to people in your social group. And so that can give you a sense of, you know, how successful are you? How smart are you? How attractive are you? But you can also look up and down, upward comparisons and what they call downward comparisons. So, if, for example, if you are saying to yourself that, I'm not as successful as so-and-so, well, someone might say to you, a good friend, might say, you know, how can you compare yourself to that person? Right? If you say to yourself, you know, I'm not as rich as Donald Trump, you know, that's just, you know, Alice might say that's being irrational. It's an upward comparison and probably not a very good one to make unless you're in Donald Trump's circles, I guess, because it's not, you know, not going to feel good about that. So if you instead, and this is what a good friend might do, might say to you, look, you know, look at how successful you are, but look what you've done with your life. And so what they do, what you can do to help someone feel better is to change their social comparison and stop getting them to compare high and get them to compare downward. Right. So because when you compare with people who aren't as good as you, then it makes us feel a little bit better. Right. So very often, I think this happens to us. Someone can tell us this, but also if you're comparing upward and, you know, making you feel a little bit sad, and then you go shopping or something, you go out into the world, and then you see people who are obviously struggling with life, who don't have much money. Maybe you see people who are out of work. And at that point, you begin to so naturally compare downward and say, wow, you know, I'm doing better than that person. So that is something, in addition to all the things we've talked about in terms of positive thinking and all that. I mean, so I think there is something to the positive thinking movement. In a second, I'm going to get to why we're revisiting it. But, these are some of the contributions that psychologists have made to make us, help us think positively and realistically and bring greater joy into our lives. And I think some of this we just do. Some of this we do naturally. You know, you don't have to have a degree in psychology to do some of these things and help your friends and help yourself think through these things. How rational is my thinking? And then being grateful, journaling, doing things for others, all good things, and social comparison theory. Who are you comparing yourself to? The example that I would bring out of my own life is that, as I've mentioned in previous podcasts, I'm a singer and have spent many a year and lots of money on singing lessons and coaching, etc. And I remember I was coaching with one particular very, very, very nice guy. His first name was also Michael. Just a wonderful man. And I remember during one of the lessons, I was complaining, saying that, well, I'm not as good a singer as insert famous tenor here. And it's so easy for us to do that, right? Because we are so easily exposed to some of the brightest and most talented people in the world. How far away is it for you to go to TED.com? That's the TED Talks, www.ted.com. And you'll see some of the brightest people in the world talk about what they do. Go into iTunes and you've got some of the most talented musicians in the world. So they're only a click away for us. So it is very easy for us to compare upward and say, geez, I'm not as smart as that guy, you know. And so during this particular lesson, I was saying that sort of thing, that I've learned a lot and become a good singer, but I'm not as good as. And so what Michael said to me was, which stuck in my mind, the expression he used was that I was spitting in the face of God. And what he meant by that was simply that, look, you have the talents that you're given. And it's wonderful that you have them, whatever they may be, whatever it is that you do. And to sit there and to say, well, but I'm not as good as so-and-so, was in his mind to spit in God's face. Good expression. We need to remember how lucky we are. Okay, so what's the negative side of this, of all this good stuff? Well, there's an interesting article, two articles that have come out recently, and I wanted to share some of what I found in them. I guess one's an article, another is a book that's coming out soon. The first one was in a recent issue of Time magazine, and I will try to get links to all of these articles for you, although they don't always stay live, but at least I'll get you the authors. In this case, this is an article called Happiness Enough Already, which I like. I think that has the best title I've heard so far. And this is by Sharon Begley, B-E-G-L-E-Y. And this article summarizes where we're at. I think she gives credit to the psychologists who have helped us to see the value in positive psychology, while at the same time really blasting this quote-unquote happiness movement. So that's Sharon Begley, and apparently she has a blog. Let's see, it's blog.newsweek.com/blogs/labnotes. So, as I say, she sort of blasts the happiness movement. I agree that there is definitely a happiness movement out there. The message being sent is that our sadness, even our normal negative reactions to things, need to be silenced. We need to avoid those. We need to get away from feeling bad, perhaps even by using a pill. And she mentions that some of the people that she interviewed have actually said that when they've expressed their sadness to their parents, the parents have mentioned that maybe they need to consider some kind of medication. So, geez, I mean, has it come to that? We can't even feel sad. And another good the points that she makes here is that we have sadness for a reason, to let ourselves know that something's not going right. Right? We need to explore and let ourselves experience what these feelings are. And she also mentions a somewhat, even what might fall into an evolutionary psychology perspective, that why do we have negative feelings? Well, they also let others know that something's not right. Right? It would be to our advantage to display negative feelings to let others know that we need help. Good quote here from this article, just a sentence. When the science of happiness collided with pop culture and the marketplace, it morphed into something even its creators hardly recognized. Right? So that's where I think she's giving credit to the psychologists who at least said, let's take a look at our thinking patterns and change them if we can. When that hit all of the pop psychology books that are out there, it's become quite a wave. So we've gone from, looking at attributions and irrational thinking to feeling that negative thoughts are must be driven from consciousness. Another article that came out, very interesting article by an English professor, Eric Wilson, and that came out in the January 18th, 2008 edition of The Chronicle, and it was called In Praise of Melancholy. Now, Dr. Wilson has written a book which is coming out soon, and it's called Against Happiness. not only does he make some of the points that I've talked about above, but he does so eloquently that I contacted him and asked him if I couldn't read a couple of paragraphs from this article. And he allowed me to do that. So let me just read a little bit from that article. "I, for one, am afraid that American culture's overemphasis on happiness at the expense of sadness might be dangerous, a wanton forgetting of an essential part of a full life. I further am concerned that to desire only happiness in a world undoubtedly tragic is to become inauthentic, to settle for unrealistic abstractions that ignore concrete situations. I am finally fearful of our society's efforts to expunge melancholia. Without the agitations of the soul, would all of our magnificently yearning towers topple? Would our heart-torn symphonies cease? My fears grow out of my suspicion that the predominant form of American happiness breeds blandness. This kind of happiness appears to disregard the value of sadness. This brand of supposed joy, moreover, seems to foster an ignorance of life's enduring and vital polarity between agony and ecstasy, dejection and ebullience. Trying to forget sadness and its integral place in the great rhythm of the cosmos, this sort of happiness insinuates that the blues are an aberrant state that should be cursed as a weakness of will, or removed with the help of a little pink pill. Our culture seems to confuse these two and thus treats melancholia as an aberrant state, a vile threat to our pervasive notions of happiness. Happiness as immediate gratification. Happiness as superficial comfort. Happiness as static contentment. Of course, the question immediately arises, who wouldn't question this apparently hollow form of American happiness? Aren't all of us late at night, when we're honest with ourselves, opposed to shallow happiness? Most likely we are. But isn't it possible that many of us fall into superficiality without knowing it? Aren't some of us so smitten with the American dream that we have become brainwashed into believing that our sole purpose on this earth is to be happy? Doesn't this unwitting affection for happiness over sadness lead us to a one-sided life, to bliss without discomfort, bright noon with no night?" Okay, and that's the quote from Eric Wilson. As you can see, he is quite the writer. So I'll have a link to that article that appeared in the Chronicle, although you will have to be a Chronicle member to see it. So once again, he has a book out called Against Happiness. All right, so let me just conclude with a couple thoughts and maybe a different sort of ending than usual. I'm sure that you know that there are times when we actually seek out sadness. We have movies called tearjerkers. And sometimes we actually enjoy, right? We enjoy a good cry. So we like connecting with these feelings. They connect us with a part of ourselves we don't often experience, and they make us feel more alive. I know that when I was young, you know, my late teens, and decided to go into psychology, I think I thought at that time, and remember I was a teenager, that being a psychologist would, I don't know, it give me some power, some ability to avoid negative things, that I would somehow know so much about human beings that I could protect myself from feeling badly about stuff. I mean, I had this vague notion that there was something about psychologists that was different from other people. And I think that, you know, overall, listen, I'm not unhappy about the choice. I have learned a lot. I think it's a great field. But it hasn't made me not human. I think when you're a teenager, you know, there's so much going on. We talked about that in the Erickson episodes. There's so much strong, powerful emotion going on, and it's natural that you would want to get some kind of control over them. But when you get older, you realize that it's all part of life. It's that song about to everything there is a season. It's somehow the song. It's not really a song. I think it's out of the Bible. But it became a song. I think it was the Birds, right? And everybody remembers it as such. But certainly is very, very true. There are times, they could be times during the day, times during the month, it could even be years, when life's just not going to go so well. And we call those the rough times, right? Everyone's life, as you know, I've been interviewing people in their older years, later years, and all of them report that, oh yeah, those were tough times. And they're referring to lengthy periods of time. So sometimes, you know, things are going to be tough, but it's not going to last forever. And sometimes you're going to, during the day, you know, you're going to feel sad. You don't know why. You know, we don't, even psychologists, you don't always know why. We don't know why. But you don't want to try to get away from that. Let yourself experience it. Maybe you need to explore something. That's why we need to revisit. I think we've got some great tools. I think psychologists have given us some great tools for thinking about our thinking. Is it rational? Does it make sense? Are there other ways to think about the situation which will result in us feeling differently? But that doesn't mean we should run away from our feelings. Okay, so I want to end the episode, as I say, a little bit differently. Thinking about how we sometimes like to feel sad reminded me of some of the music that really affects me and really makes me feel a little bit sad. And some of these are, maybe you know some of these, the ones that just came to my head. And they're not contemporary music because I'm, you know, I'm into some of the classical music. Maybe you've heard of a song called O Mio Babbino Caro, which is part of, I'm sure you have. It's everywhere. It's from the opera Johnny Schicchi by Puccini. Beautiful, beautiful song. It's actually not supposed to be, well, one conductor I worked with said it's not really supposed to be a sad song, but it always is sung that way, and it's beautiful. Other songs, music that you may have heard that's kind of sad, it would be, of course, Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. That's a beautifully lonely song. Chopin has a beautiful number called Tristesse. If you're feeling sad, it might be worthwhile to explore some of this music. The Lakmé duet is beautiful, a duet for two females by Delibes. And Debussy's Clair de Lune is also gorgeous. And you know, this is true, I was watching Lost, as usual, and the composer there, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Giacchino, I think, has written some wonderfully sad music for that show. So check that out. But I want to end the episode with a piece of music that, among all of these, is just beautiful. And it's the intermezzo from, who was it, Mascagni's opera called Cavalleria Rusticana. And it's, I heard this piece of music live a few years ago, and it is just gorgeous. You may not recognize it by the name, but it has this sad, sweet quality to it. Makes you feel like someone's calling to you. Just gorgeous. It makes you want to take up the violin, because of course the violin has some kind of quality to make us, to really touches us. I know one of the Psych Files listeners plays the oboe, and maybe she can tell us if there are oboes in this piece as well. At any rate, let me end this episode. This is the end of the episode, but I do want to just leave you. I was able to find a public domain recording of the intermezzo, so I'm going to end the episode with this gorgeous piece of music. And then I'll see you next time on the Psych Files. Thanks a lot. Take care.